This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, I'm delighted to be talking with the one and the only Ralph Nader, the relentless consumer advocate and public citizen, the person who more than anyone else in this country was instrumental in the founding of the EPA and OSHA and may have saved more Americans' lives than anyone except for the person who came up with the polio vaccine, Jonas Salk. Ralph Nader is my guest today. Ralph Nader has run for president several times. He's written many nonfiction books. Now he's the author of his first novel, Only the Super Rich Can Save Us. Ralph Nader, welcome back to Progressive Radio.
Thank you, Matt.
It's great to see you again. Why did you decide to try your hand at fiction after all these years?
Well, it liberates the imagination and gets people thinking in a wider range of possibilities. You know, when I go down to Congress these days and we make proposals for the obvious, like why don't you tax speculative derivatives on Wall Street, and get a lot of revenue, or single-payer health care and so on, all we hear is variations on two replies. It can't happen or it's not practical. Now, that's not the way this country put its best foot forward in the past.
It's the same answer, too.
Yeah. Essentially. Imagine the civil rights movement early on saying, it's not practical. So we've got to up the ante, raise people to higher levels of expectation, especially of the enlightened super rich, who when they reach a certain age in the 70s, 80s, 90s, I think they're ready for something different than just soft philanthropy.
You know, the title of the book, and I read it also, the substance of the book, seemed to startle me at the beginning because I know you and your philosophy of citizen power, of empowerment, of institution building across the country, not just in Washington. And I know Howard Zinn's view of the way history changes, that it changes from the bottom up. And so this looks like a top-down approach. In a sense, kind of a Hail Mary for progressives' future. And I'm just wondering why that approach? Why do you think that's important? Have you given up the hope of change bubbling up from below?
Well, it's a top-down, bottom-up, because the 17 billionaires who got together in a mountaintop hotel in Maui, Hawaii, in January 2006, when this fictional work took place, led by Warren Buffett, $50 billion worth of net worth, strategy of taking on the corporate Goliaths and their Washington allies and to rework the country's directions and priorities, healthcare, living wage, curbing corporate crime and election reform and so on, they knew they couldn't do it without mobilizing the mass of the people, which they do brilliantly in the book, as they learn by doing. They have mass media and they create Congress watchdog groups and all kinds of patterns of motivated, mobilized citizenry. So it's top down, bottom up. You know, we should remember the civil rights movement got infusions from multimillionaires, the Stern family in New Orleans, the Curry family in Virginia. Same for the abolition movement. The important thing is that they knew right off, the billionaires in this book, that they could be a catalyst, they could be a shoehorn, they could provide billions of dollars, but it had to be grassroots.
But it is a kind of reflection of your frustration level, I think.
Oh, yes.
And now you've been in Washington 5 decades almost.
Yeah.
And it appears to be getting harder and harder. I mean, I remember Senator Durbin saying, you know, the banks own this place.
Yeah.
And that was just a couple months ago.
It is getting harder and harder. All these progressive groups in Washington who send us funding appeals, you know, Common Cause, Public Citizens, Sierra Club, ACLU, they're working harder and harder for less and less. I've never seen a more cowardly group of senators and representatives, with very few exceptions, like Kucinich. The cowardliness is so staggering that in real life, Warren Buffett went to the Senate, met with Senate Democrats 3 weeks ago, and he said that you should tax the very wealthy more because they're undertaxed like me. And he said, for example, I paid 16% federal income tax last year. My secretary paid 25%. And they treated him like he had drug-resistant tuberculosis.
Well, what's the cause of that cowardliness?
One is they're too safe in their campaign, in their jobs. You know, they've been pretty much gerrymandered, or they don't have real opponents. Two, money. They get big money from commercial sources. And Obama got more money from Wall Street commercial sources than McCain by far. And the third is, it's an easy way to go through a legislative career. You know, you're wined, you're dined, nobody's going to challenge you in the primary because you've catered to the wealthy who could. And after a while, that's the kind of person who runs for the Senate or the House. It's such a stark difference than the Democrats in the 60s. If we had the same Democrats, I can almost assure you, Matt, we would have single-payer health insurance, a living wage, and a lot of things that have been dragging and being dragged into non-implementation for years. And we're way behind Western Europe now and Canada in these social services.
You mentioned Obama and his money from Wall Street. There were a lot of progressives who supported Obama. Some did with illusions and some did with fewer illusions, but certainly he has not turned out to be very progressive. What is your take on what's happened to Obama?
Well, I think he had a lot of Clinton in him, which is you get along by going along with the power structure. And he's not a transforming leader that takes on power. I mean, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, you should say, he reveled in those who hated him. He used those phrases, you know, because that showed the public whose side he was on. And, the economic royalists, as he called them.
I wonder about his personality, because some of the things that helped him during the campaign are hurting him in the White House. His cautiousness, his, you know, being, right, you know, really careful, very, you know, looking at every angle before deciding what to do, because he doesn't seem to have a real sense of what he wants to do. And he also seems to want to please people. He doesn't want to be criticized by the establishment or the columnists or the pundits.
Exactly right.
And if you have
harmony ideology.
That is not the right personality for the times.
No. And he's conflict averse when it comes to the powerful. And that's the way he was back in the state Senate in Illinois and in his early Senate career in Washington. And he was certainly afraid to take on a military-industrial complex.
I mean, he said that during the campaign that he was going to raise Pentagon spending, and he's raising Pentagon spending.
Exactly. And the continuity with Bush is stunning. Leave No Child Behind continuity. Afghanistan more than continuity. Faith-based initiatives like Bush. There's not that much difference in his approach to Wall Street. And look at his concessions in the health care. I mean, you don't even know what he stands for anymore, and he never draws a line in the sand. He's not like LBJ. And he's got the wrong personality for our times.
Mm-hmm. But he has done some things that, you know, McCain probably wouldn't have done. Lilly Ledbetter law, allowing women to sue for sexual harassment, Sonia Sotomayor. I mean, he's done better on global warming, certainly, than his predecessor. And
although McCain was very good on global warming. But that's the point, you know. As long as our approach is, well, the Republicans are worse, therefore we have to vote for and support the Democrats, that means we lose our bargaining power by pulling the Democrats to the progressive side. But, you know, the companies never stop pulling both parties to their side. So every 4 years, that kind of least worst voting ensures that both parties get worse. You know, the liberal Republicans of the 70s would be left Democrats today.
I think some people some people who voted third party a couple times before didn't vote for you last time because they thought that the risk of continuing Bush-Cheneyism was so great, the direction toward out-and-out fascism in this country, that risk was too powerful. And maybe the need to elect the first black president of the United States was strong enough. Those didn't persuade you, though.
No, because, there are 40 slam-dunk Republican McCain or Obama states. So in those areas, they could have sent a message to Obama and voted for the Nader-Gonzalez ticket or the Nader-Camejo ticket. The second is, let them vote for Obama, but why signal it and not condition their vote and play it hard to get in April, May, June, July, August? Because once you signal that you got nowhere to go and you're going to vote for Obama because he's not as bad as Bush, why should Obama pay any attention to you? Why should he make speeches that have progressive content? Why should he campaign in poor areas? Because the poor, you know, they're not going to vote Republican. I don't like politicians who take people for granted.
What is the future of third parties in the United States, Ralph Nader? Your couple runs came in about 2.7% at the top.
It's very hard. I mean, Teresa Amato, my campaign manager, just put out a book called Grand Delusion, the Myth of Voter Choice in a Two-Party Tyranny, where she lays out her experience and roots it in history, third-party struggles, ballot access obstacles, harassment by litigation. The Democrats filed 24 lawsuits, imagine, in 12 weeks in 2004 in 18 states to get us off the ballot. Our petitioners on the streets were harassed. So in answer to your question, it'll be a billionaire, like Perot, and maybe Bloomberg in 2012 writes himself a $600 million check, doesn't have to call anybody for money, and it's an immediate three-way race. And that's not the way I'd like it to happen. But it looks like people grow up thinking and believing, not entirely erroneously, that there are only two choices on the ballot for president.
I just met someone, a Native American woman in Wisconsin, who was the first woman to graduate, a woman of color to graduate from one of the state schools here. And she was born to a family that was a Progressive Party family. So when they asked her in high school what party she was for, she was the only one raised her hand and said Progressive Party. She told me she didn't think there were any other parties but the Progressive Party.
Well, a lot of it starts very young age. And we found a real bad situation in 2008 where millions of school kids were being introduced into the presidential campaign, and the materials were written by Scholastic magazine, and they basically just had Obama and McCain. And I learned this because a mother, her son, her 9-year-old son in western Minnesota, went there, and he said, I want to vote for Nader Gonzalez. And the teacher says, you can't do that. And you got to just look at the materials. You got to vote for one or the other. So here you have millions of kids being indoctrinated by this corporation.
So you're off the ballot in the curriculum in school. That's nasty. In your book, you talk about lowering the voting age to 16. The book is Only the Super Rich Can Save Us. Why do you want to lower it to 16?
Well, one is I want to introduce voting responsibility to a younger age. If you're young enough to work, you should be young enough to vote. And within a year, you're young enough to go into the military services. And I think the dialogue back home is better. I think the younger the children are, the more aggressive they are in discussing it around the dinner table.
Back to third parties just for a second, and then I want to get back to your book because it's an interesting book, Only the Super Rich Can Save Us. And that is the Greens. There was more of a hope in 2000 that you were going to be institutional building with the Green Party, and then when you didn't run with them the last two times, that seemed to take some of the rationale away from the movement and also seemed to be a bit of a departure from your institution building. Why did you make that choice?
Well, after 40 visits and fundraisers after 2000 to try to build the Green Party, and all I raised went to the Green Party, it was like pushing a string. They have so many internal conflicts, many of them personality conflicts, not policy conflicts. And then they were starting to say in 2004, maybe we won't field the president. And when are you going to decide, I asked. Well, in their June convention in Milwaukee. Well, I said, you know, that's a little late. You can't get on the ballot if you have to run independent. And so I had to start early. I'm sorry to say that. But
are you going to run again, do you think?
I want a progressive agenda on that ballot, and I'd love someone else to run, like Jim Hightower, who, after all, was elected Secretary of Agriculture in Texas and is fairly well-known around the country.
Have you been talking to him about that?
I always urge them to run, and Barbara Ehrenreich and others, many of them contributors to the Progressive magazine, but it's a terrible grind. And also, you lose a lot of friends that way. Some people want to be loved, Matt.
Yeah, but maybe the friends come back.
Well, they can't say our predictions were wrong.
That they can't.
And they can't say our policies were uncongenial to their policies. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think you're right on both those fronts. I'm talking with Ralph Nader. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine. And we're speaking with Ralph about, of course, third parties and American politics, power, corporate power in Washington, and also Ralph Nader's first novel, Only the Super Rich Can Save Us. In this book, which I'm going to let you describe in kind of architectural detail if you want. Yeah. But you have a critique of charity. I'm interested in the concepts in the book as much as the plot. And you say you have a billionaire who's spending his charity, not a great deal of charity either, and a group that you call Kill the Tapeworms and Lice Children's Association.
Yeah.
And then I just heard you talk, and you said a society that wants more justice needs less charity. What is behind this critique of charity?
It doesn't go to the root causes. So charity will do a very important job of, say, of setting up soup kitchens for the urban hungry. But it won't go to the source. Why does a modern productive economy have anybody who's hungry or anybody who's poor? I mean, Western Europe has essentially abolished poverty as we see it in our cities and rural areas. You know, they came out of World War II devastated. We came out the colossus. And what's our excuse? So maybe our excuse is we don't have a multi-party system. We don't have strong trade unions. We don't have co-ops. And that's the whole trajectory when these 17 billionaires and mega millionaires got together. And they're real people. They're Warren Buffett, George Soros, Ted Turner, Phil Donahue, Paul Newman, who passed away recently, unfortunately, Yoko Ono, Bill Cosby, Peter Lewis. I mean, people are fairly well known, and they all bring something to their table. And so they become an enormously more powerful force. One, because they're going for justice. They're going for power shifts, taking from the few to the many, developing grassroots mobilization. A head-on power collision is quite dramatic, actually, with the corporate Goliaths and their political allies in Washington, who counterattack about July in the middle of the year. By the way, the protagonists in this book decided they were going to do it all in 1 year. They figured surprise is key. If you stretch it out, the forces of reaction can counterattack more and more and more. And that's been the lesson in Washington. If you stretch it out too long, I mean, we got the auto industry regulated in 6 months in 1966. If the Democrats in Congress said, hey, you can't do that, biggest industry, let's lay it out more, lay it out into next 67, 68, we wouldn't have gotten it. And so there are a lot of realistic things. People who read this book, Only Super Rich Can Save Us, which is in quotes, by the way, and it comes from an experience that Warren Buffett had after Katrina, bringing truckloads of supplies after he couldn't believe these stranded, terrified people were not being helped. And a grandmother grabbed his hands, looked into his eyes. He was helping their extended family and cried, only the super rich can save us. And that haunted him on the way back on the road to Omaha. And that's when he decided to get these people together in Maui. But the point is that right from the beginning, they had a whole series of exciting strategies that we can learn from. So if you read this book, you're going to be a stronger citizen. You're going to have higher expectations of yourself. You will never be as inhibited in asking rich people for money. I guarantee you on that one. And what's interesting is you'll see that stereotyping super rich older people is a big mistake, because a slice of them, maybe a small slice, is starting to have second thoughts about what they want to be remembered for, and they can be part of the solution.
That Warren Buffett anecdote you talked about is a fictional one. Did you talk to Warren Buffett, ask permission to use him? How were you able to use these real live characters?
I didn't ask permission. I mean, that's a fictional license. It's been done to me. But Warren Buffett, I read the biographies of these people. You know, Warren Buffett's father was a populist, in some ways radical Republican member of Congress in 1946, 1950 from Nebraska. He came out against imperialism and the way the Cold War is being conducted and how corporations were making profit. He was like that retired Marine General Smedley Butler. So people don't know about some of the things these people in my book have done in real life. Access to justice. William Gates Sr., he's the one who helped organize with Chuck Collins 1,000 rich people to save the estate tax that were teetering on oblivion by the Republican-run Congress. So I don't lobotomize these people and start them new. I draw on what they've done and said and escalate it enormously. There's a great phrase in the book that comes from Yoko Ono, which is her words. We need somersaults of the mind. And she provides an aesthetic dimension to their fight to their strategy, taking on the corporate Goliaths.
Have you met her before?
Yes.
And what's she like in person?
She's just like the way she is in the book. She's very imaginative. She'll bust the paradigm in these endless conversations and dialogues that they have to plan one strategy after another. You know, she brings them down to earth about the moral sentiments. She tries to make sure they take care of themselves and don't overwork. But they, you know, they start a people's chamber of commerce. They start an internal sub-economy by buying up businesses for sustainability and for intelligence feedback from the trade associations. And, you know, they start a clean elections party, and which fields candidates primarily taking on the unopposed veteran Republicans who control the House and Senate committees.
And that's an avenue that, you know, we don't really need a billionaire for right away. I mean, there are these people who run unopposed for re-election.
Right.
And people in even the established parties could do it, or in third parties could do it. That avenue's open.
Exactly. And that's what people will say. You know, there's certain things we can do without billions of dollars. But this whole enormous transformation and jolting of the country along traditional justice lines without countering the rhythms of the American people and not discounting people from the American Legion and VFW with hundreds of lecturers that went around speaking in communities all over the country. $15 billion, Matt.
But
that's what it took. I'm telling you.
Flip side, though, is if these billionaires don't produce, it sounds like we're doomed.
Well, we are not getting anywhere unless we can raise the resources, whether through the internet or whatever. But the key is the minute they moved into the action field out of Maui, they were given credibility by the press, because even though the press didn't quite know for a few months that they were all coordinated, the minute billionaires move into social justice arenas, ipso facto, they get free media.
But, you know, a traditional progressive perspective is, you know, we could have social action like there was in the 30s. We could have general strike. We could have environmentalists, you know, arm in arm with unionists like they were in Seattle. And is that still not possible?
Well, it hasn't happened. Nobody's gone around the country more than I have, and it just doesn't happen. You get very enthusiastic audiences, and it's over. You sign them up, and then they drift away, and you don't hear from them, even after you contact them. You know how hard it is to get people out to a meeting, town council or a labor meeting. What happens is they invigorate Labor Day. You know, Labor Day, now the parades are down to stragglers, even in Detroit.
I see make fun of, and properly so, the labor movement for not taking more advantage of Labor Day and using it as an organizing day.
Exactly. And by the way, Saul Price is one of the mega millionaires. He takes on Walmart. He started the big box discount movement. And when the Walmart moguls saw that Saul Price was the leader behind this very sophisticated strategy of unionizing Walmart workers, they were terrified. That's the point. He knew everything about them, their vulnerabilities. He could get stockholders, to call the board of directors. We've got to use the progressive wealthy in their advanced years when they want to look into the eyes of their grandchildren and answer their question, where were you when our country was disintegrating? That's a huge human resource. And look what 17 of them did. And let me tell you, they provoked a massive counterattack where the corporate Goliaths wanted to smear them and generate fears they were going to wreck the economy with their changes and block them in the Congress. So it's a way of just taking all this civic action to a new level of imagination. I might say, just going decade after decade, the way progressives are, brilliant exposés in books and articles, and brilliant documentation, diagnosis, proposals for change, and we're getting nowhere. That's a dystopia.
Yeah, this is
if you want a dystopia, that's it.
This is Ralph Nader talking about his utopia, Only the Super Rich Can Save Us. And as you gathered, this is the frustration of someone who's worked harder probably than anybody else in the last 40 or 50 years in Washington to try to bring about change and also set up institutions that have some longevity now. I want to talk about a concept I may never have talked to you about, and that is patriotism, because in your book you have a couple riffs on changing the Pledge of Allegiance to "With Liberty and Justice for Some" and changing the national anthem to "America the Beautiful."
Right.
Why do you include those two things?
One is to decoy and distract the right-wing massive audience talk show hosts. They wanted to decoy and distract what I called in the book Bush Bimbo and Pawn Vanity and others. And so they gave them red meat. And the red meat that went on for weeks of these guys ranting and raving and not paying any attention to the building movement of the billionaires who called themselves meliorists worked like a charm. And one was to propose, and they put it on advertisers around the country, changing national anthem from Star Spangled Banner to American the Beautiful. And then they got inner city school teachers whose budgets and crumbling schools to get their students to pledge allegiance by changing the last few words with liberty and justice for some. And of course the right wing went into a fury. Well, that was all a decoy and distraction. Just another example of the strategies they thought up.
But is there a substantive point you were trying to make?
Yeah, there is, which is that patriotism is a manipulative tool of enormous proportions. And if you give up the flag and this and the anthem to the right wing and the corporatists, you know, you're under a huge handicap. And the flag was never meant to do more than the Pledge of Allegiance with liberty and justice for all. And why not consider America the Beautiful? Isn't that what we really stand for? So it deconstructs right-wing control of patriotic symbols. They also had a mascot called Patriotic Polly, who performed spectacularly.
This was a parrot.
A parrot, a macaw parrot.
I want to talk a little bit about your vision for the country. You didn't call this group revolutionaries. You called them meliorists,
right,
to ameliorate the problems of society. And you say in the book that it at bottom really isn't a fundamental challenge to even the free market. Explain that.
Well, it's what are called long overdue improvements. That's the first stage. In fact, on page 76, the seven pillars that they pushed forward, that was led: economic inequality, very poor wages, battered pensions, no health insurance, all these things Western Europe, you know, way ahead of us on, even Canada. So, however, they laid the groundwork for permanent institutions that would go for even more fundamental change, like taking away corporate personhood. William Gates Sr. in this fiction would have people incorporate themselves in mass jamborees, saying, okay, if corporations have all these advantages, I'm going to incorporate myself, be able to do all the things I can't do as a real human being. So they laid an educational base and an institutional base for the future. And one of the pillars were focusing on posterity.
And posterity is something we don't think enough about, even though posterity is right there in the preamble to the Constitution of the United States. Is this going to be your last novel, or are you working on another novel, Ralph Nader?
I want to expand the genre of practical utopia. I think a lot of people have practical utopias, especially frustrated people who've lost a lot of battles. And so we have a website called onlythesuperrich.org. And let's make this into a bestseller, folks, because I think it will really jolt the imagination of the American people to taking back the controls.
The website, again, is onlythesuperrich.org.
Yes.
And Ralph Nader's been my guest today on Progressive Radio. Ralph Nader, great to see you again.
Thank you. And thank the Progressive Magazine.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.